the recording. Thank you. Let's come to order, please. Welcome to the November 14th meeting of the Pelham PUD Commission. This is a hybrid meeting. Let's dive right in here. Comments from the public. Dee, do we have anybody that's online or?
If anyone would like to make a public comment at this time, please raise your hand or state your name.
Okay, thank you. Sean, do we have any agenda revisions?
Not today.
Great. All right, approval of the consent agenda. We have five items on there which were sent out previously, so every commission could look them over. Is there questions or comments on the agenda time? Consent agenda.
I move that we approve the consent agenda.
I second the motion.
Been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda for November the 14th, 2022. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you.
Oh, that's right.
That's paper for now.
Signed. I don't know if I missed any. I think I got one. Oh, I did this one. Okay, we'll move on to business items. First item is acceptance memo for cost increase to agreement number 200328 for Pelham Bay CQ water main upgrades pre-construction. Tom?
Good afternoon, Commissioners. This is a change order under this agreement 200328, which is with Murray Smith and Associates. They're the design engineer for their Pelham Bay CQ water main upgrades. So the pre-construction phase is done. So this is work that they performed back last spring that we're finally getting around to getting a change order for. And the change order was for just additional work that was required to coordinate with WashDOT mostly. They had to get updated variances from WashDOT and make all that documentation. The variance was needed because there was original plans to horizontal directional drill under Highway 112 right to Pelham Bay. And that was going to be very expensive and just infeasible in some places, so we asked them to do open cutting. So it was a whole new round of design changes during the month of March. And really, we're trying to get this final design set out so we can go out for bid. And I just said, okay, well, we need to do this work. We want to keep this project on schedule.
Yeah.
So they just went ahead and did that. So staff is asking my commission to approve this change order for increase the contract cost by $8,753.36.
You anticipate any other changes, Tom?
No, the design is done. We're actually moving into construction now. So, yeah.
But for cost increases, they usually happen more during the design or the implementation or construction?
There's probably more going to be in the construction
phase. That's what I was
saying. Yeah. Because there's a lot of unknowns in Cloud Bay. It's an old system. There's been a lot of work done out there. It has not been documented. And so we're finding all sorts of infrastructure in the way where we're trying to dig. So,
well, the same thing's happening on a remodel of my house where, you know, a number of assumptions were made, and we're finding that they're not true now.
Welcome. So the firm that did the design will also follow construction, or is it the same thing?
Yeah, they're the engineer of record, so they're reviewing all the submittals and requests for information as the design engineer of record.
Sounds like we got more change orders coming. So.
Well, through the construction phase. Yeah.
Through the construction phase, that's right. Okay, thank you, Tom. Do we have a motion on this one?
I move that we accept the memo for cost increase to agreement number 200328 for Clallam Bay System Water Main Upgrades Pre-Construction.
I second the motion.
Moved and seconded to approve an acceptance memo for a cost increase to agreement number 200328 for Clallam Bay CQ Water Main Upgrades Pre-construction, originally contracted at $349,452. Due to delays and design changes with Washington State Department of Transportation, previous change orders were approved to extend the agreement time and add to the scope of work with additional project costs for a total project cost not to exceed $388,467. The additional scope of work and time increases the agreement by $8,753.36 for a total project cost of $397,220.36. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks, Tom.
Hopefully we'll see you back up here next meeting.
Yep.
That way we can pat you on the back before you retire.
But no more change orders. Okay, our next item is acceptance memo for completion for bid number 220805 for the Fork Substation Upgrade. Doug?
Good afternoon. So as of now, Olympic Electric has completed all their work, and I'm asking the board to accept the memo of completion for the Fork Substation 220805.
So they got that swimming pool put in okay at the substation?
Oh, yeah. And it's been filled with water.
It's too cold to use, right?
Anything noteworthy to bring to our attention with respect to the finish of this project?
We are finishing up testing this week, and so it should be back online next week as long as we can schedule everybody appropriately.
So does this bring his substation in line with kind of our standard design?
Yes, so it'll have our newest vacuum breakers. It'll have all the new electronic choice relays. So we will be up to date and online with data, same as the rest of the county.
Fantastic.
So this was the last substation in that whole upgrade scheme.
All right. Good. So do we have a motion on this one?
I move that we accept memo of completion for bid number 220805 for the Fork Substation Upgrade.
I second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded to approve acceptance memo for completion for bid number 220805 for completion of upgrades to the Fork Substation. Olympic Electric Company, Inc. completed the project for a total contract cost of $612,044.03, including Washington State sales tax. The project replaced aging equipment at the Ford substation to bring up to current industry standards. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job, Doug.
All right, our next item is acceptance memo for completion of bid number 220803 for pole inspection, treating, and reporting. Terry?
So, as of November 4th, 2022, Pacific Pole Inspectors LLC has satisfactorily inspected, treated, and reported on 2,255 electrical transmission and distribution poles at a not to exceed price of $137,132. The final cost was $136,750 plus Washington State sales tax. Staff recommends that the commission accept all work under bid number 220803 as complete. Thanks.
I've got a different dollar number here, $148,782.
Now, I believe that includes the Washington State sales tax.
All that does.
The two different types of tax.
All right, good.
Terry, when it says treating the poles, I had always assumed that all the treating was done beforehand.
It is. So we buy the poles, the butts are treated. That's the only part of them. When they come back and inspect them, some of that stuff will start to rot after time. The longer time goes by, the more it rots. They'll spud some of that away with a sharp tool, and then they put a new treatment around it. It's a little bit different treatment, and it's a little thicker, and it stays on. Then they put paper around, and it kind of helps the pole hold up a ground line a little better.
So
that's the only place they actually treat it, is just right down from the ground line.
Okay, right at the interface between the ground and the earth.
Yeah, that's kind of where they rot out. You know, that 2 inches above ground to about a foot below ground. That's, you know, they rot other places too, but that's kind of the main spot, so they treat that again.
So they dig that out, like a foot down or so?
Yeah, the requirement, they're required to dig down 18 inches around the pole and inspect it, drill it below the ground line, spud off rot, and treat that again. Yeah, and then they also take a look at the top of the pole, take pictures for us, and they do a lot better reporting than they used to.
Yeah, I was thought that they would also maybe put something on the top of the pole. Is that covered? Or?
Well, we call it a frisbee, a pole topper. Mm-hmm. We've used different types over the years, but anymore we use these black frisbees, and that keeps the water from getting in the top grain and turn into what we call a castle top.
Right.
A little finger sticking up and it rots down.
Yeah, used to they had persistent insecticides and herbicides that last about 100 years. Like DDT.
Yeah, we can't use the stuff that really
I know you
can. But for good environmental reasons.
So. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I move we accept the memo of completion for bid number 220803 for the pole inspection, treating, and reporting.
I second the motion.
Been moved and seconded to approve acceptance memo for completion for bid number 220803 for pole inspection, treating, and reporting of 2,255 electrical transmission and distribution poles. Pacific Pole Inspection LLC completed the project for a total contract cost of $148,782.15, including Washington State sales tax. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Terry. The next item is Resolution 2253, adopting the 2023 budget. Ruth?
I'm
going to
first do a final budget
presentation, and then we'll... Yeah, that's fine, sure.
You want the last one here? Mistakes out here. What do you actually look at?
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Today I'll be presenting the final revision of the proposed.
Would you put the mic down so I can?
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
Today I'll be presenting the final revision of the proposed 2023 budget, which includes the changes since the October work session. At the end, I'll then present a resolution to pass the 2023 budgets for all three divisions. If at any point you have any questions, just go ahead and stop me. Here we have the 2023 budget changes broken out by division. Overall, the change to the electric budget is an increase of $779,000. For inflows, there's no anticipated change to electric inflows. For outflows, labor and benefits increased due to the addition of a receptionist in customer service, and that's to help with phone volume and also to take payments. There was a change of positions in engineering. They're changing an engineering tech to a GIS specialist, and that is a slightly higher pay range. Insurances and taxes increased due to the position ads changes, and also there was an increase in healthcare premiums and an increase in Washington paid family medical leave. And administration, EDC dues increased. That was per a request of the EDC, and they'll be doing a presentation later this month. Safety awards increased from $1,200 to $20,000. This was per a request of our new safety manager, who plans to implement a new program that recognizes departments for no time loss. PERMs, liability, and cyber premiums increased a total of $31,000. This increase is based on new estimates from the PERMs committee, and those costs are primarily driven by cybercrime and wildfires.
Ruth, on the safety awards, I think I misheard you. So we now have an award that we're given to departments if they have no injuries.
Yeah, the new safety manager has a program that he wants to implement this next year. So departments that can go, say, every quarter with no time loss, they would get some sort of award for being safe.
So I'm curious, how does that work with respect to, I understand that with respect to linemen and people working in the field, but what about the folks that are in the office here? I mean, is there any?
It's primarily geared towards operations.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's worked well elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, peer pressure to get that award. So.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sean. Okay, for capital, overall capital increased approximately $476,000. This is primarily due to the carryover of vehicle procurement from 2022. There's just a really long delay in getting those vehicles.
So I'm assuming then that the delay on the delivery, but did we pay for the vehicle in 22? Or?
No, we have not yet paid for the vehicles yet.
So then I'm assuming there was a bit of a surplus at the end of 22 from not having paid for the vehicle then? And,
correct.
Okay.
So if you were to net 22 and 23, it's okay. Approximately the same. As far as additions, a selling trailer was added for $49,000. We also had a net reduction of $60,000 in transmission project work. Overall change to the water budget is a decrease of $71,000. Water inflows reduced slightly due to a reduction in interest dollars to the operating fund. The interest capital fund was not included in the work session years, so that's corrected here. We're also anticipating an increase in FEMA monies, and this results in a net reduction to inflows of $4,500. Water's outflows reduced due to a slight increase in insurances and taxes, as well as a decrease in capital costs. That results in a net reduction to outflows. For wastewater, overall, the change to the wastewater budget is an increase of $150. Wastewater's inflows reduced slightly due to a correction to the interest dollars. Like water, the interest to the capital fund has been included in the work session. And lastly, wastewater's outflows increased slightly due to an increase in insurances and taxes. Here we have the summary for the electric division showing the actuals for 21, the updated projections for 22, and the updated proposed budget for 23. 2022 projections changed. As noted earlier, we're anticipating a significant delay in vehicle procurement, pushing 2022 vehicles into 23 and one into 24. This increased our net change operating reserve for 2022 to 5.8 million, the previous amount of 4.3. 23, the previously noted changes and carryover resulted in a revised net change in operating reserve of 1.5 million versus the previous amount of 2.3. Here we have a summary for the water division. 2022 projections changed primarily due to a correction in interest projections, as well as an increase in fourth quarter capital spend. For 23, the big change is the decrease in capital, resulting in a revised net change in operating reserves of $321,000 versus the previous amount of $250,000. There's no material change in wastewater's 2022 projections, and the $660 change in 23 is primarily due to the interest allocation correction. Our final slide here shows the 2023 budgets for all three divisions, and this is included in the resolution as well. And that's it. So if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer those.
Questions, comments? I think we should just cut 10% out of it.
Well, I suggest that we, I guess this is where we can make proposed changes to the budget.
Oh, we could. I mean, what we're doing here today is presenting the budget as final and asking to have the budget passed.
Okay. Well, I would like to change the EDC and the Northwest River Partners to 5,000 for each of them individually.
Okay.
So that's my motion.
Okay, we can take that as a separate motion. It's been moved and seconded to reduce the budget for the Economic Development Council and River Partners dues to $5,000 each.
Was that seconded?
Sorry?
Was that
I'm just restating it.
Don't we normally do that in January and kind of go over long?
Well, we're approving the budget now, so basically it should be.
Now that you do it. Hmm? We're approving the budget now.
Well, yeah, it seems sort of, then we should be looking at all the other groups.
But you can look at them if you want to. I chose to look at those two.
Well, I don't, okay, so I disagree with the EDC budget at 5. I think they've been doing a stellar job. They're bringing us a lot of goodwill input. I know maybe Sean can comment on that too. I don't think we should be cutting them. I don't disagree with your cut on Northwest River Partners.
Okay, well, I'll second that motion. So it's been moved and seconded to reduce the contribution to Economic Development Council and River Partners to $5,000 each. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So on the resolution for the budget, just approve it with those changes.
Okay, we can do that.
So I move that we accept the budget as presented with the two changes that have been made today.
Okay.
Do we have a second?
I don't know what I'm going to approve the EDC cut.
Okay. Well, I'll second that motion. So it's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 2253-22 adopting the 2023 Electric Operating Fund, Water Operating Fund, and Wastewater Operating Fund budgets that's finally determined with the exception of the EDC and River Partners revisions to $5,000 each. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. All right.
Good job, Ruth.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks a lot, Ruth. Hey, we're saving money here. What a deal. All right, BPA post-2028 contract discussions. I'm not sure I had anything. But.
I have one thing. I talked to our account rep, Marcus Perry, and he said that on the 10th, BPA had an initial draft to your letter to them regarding the West End line. He said that it has to go through an initial review and edit process at the administrative level, and then to expect a response within 2 to 3 weeks. So they have it, they've acknowledged it, and they have a draft ready to send to us, but probably mid-December is when we'll get
No indication of.
Didn't get any indication from him on what the letter said.
One of the things that concerns me that has been discussed is moving away from critical water planning. Historically, the Northwest has done, because the majority of our resource stack is hydro changes from year to year, not only the volume of water you get, but when the water comes off. And to compensate or to manage that uncertainty, the region historically has used what we call critical water. Critical water meaning that if you were to record all the snow and rainfall in a given year and then put them in a list, the critical waters would be at the very bottom. So they're the lowest that you get. And the reason we do that is that we're depending upon, or we're trying to define firm. Firm meaning that you can depend on it. So Clark, as you may know, Clark County PUD lost their River Road combustion turbine. So they've been scrambling. They're scrambling to want Bonneville to pick up that generation that they lost. And they're the primary movers of moving away from critical water planning. The potential impact to a utility like us is that if you start calling non-firm generation firm, then you're putting Bonneville in the position of having to go out and purchase power to make up for what didn't come down as rain or snow. And as you can well imagine, what the market might be doing when there's not a lot of rain and snow, the prices are going to be very high. And if Bonneville is committed to providing a lot of extra generation, then that's going to mean they're going to be exposed to a lot of risk in the marketplace. I've been pushing back against trying the utilities that are trying to augment the system And the latest, or this as I view as the latest attempt, which is to move away from critical water planning, I do not think will be beneficial to the ratepayers of our PUD. So I've been pushing back on that, and we'll see how that ends up. But to me, that's, I think, the most significant risk that we're dealing with in the new contract.
Yeah, I think I've said before, Bonneville has approached Energy Northwest saying if they want to augment the hydro system with 1,000 megawatts, and that would be renewables and perhaps participation in a small modular reactor or maybe multiple SMRs. So they're pursuing that, and those talks are still going on. How is that going to find its way into our rates? It sounds a little ominous.
Yeah, I think it's, as John has pointed out, that we expect in the next, as we transition away from internal combustion engines and into electric vehicles, we expect the load at our PUD to increase by 30%. If you put that on top of potentially going, you know, augmenting the system and Bonneville and moving away from critical water, I see a lot of risk for our utility. And I think Ryan from WAPAG has done a pretty good job, and he's going to be making a presentation to Bonneville. Basically, what Ryan from WAPAG has done is started out as he's partitioned the public power customers into three groups. And he's calling the group one as the high conservation. In other words, utilities that have gone above and beyond are putting in a lot of conservation. Group two are ones that have had high load growth, and those are typically up and down the I-5 corridor. And then group three are us, utilities like us anyway, that have not done a lot of conservation, although we've done a good amount. We're not, you know, up there with the 5% of folks, and we haven't had a lot of load growth. And thus far, in my opinion, groups one and groups two have been leading the discussions in the BPA negotiations, heavy focus on augmentation. I've really been applauding Ryan for doing a good job of recognizing that not every utility is in those two extremes, and there's a lot of folks in the middle like us in group three. And he's come up with an alternative that he's going to be presenting to Bonneville, and I'm assuming most people have seen this. He's calling it, which is an appropriate name, I think, the no worse off alternative. And the reason he coined it that way was that if Bonneville awards the utilities that have done a lot of conservation, and if Bonneville listens to the ones that have had a lot of load growth, it's going to really hurt utilities like Kalala. And how would it hurt? Well, basically what it does is it pushes us into Tier 2. And just as a simple way of thinking of the difference between Tier 1 and Tier 2, Tier 1 has all of the hydro system in it, all of Bonneville's existing resources. Is that right, John?
Yes, sir. Tier 1 includes the system that Columbia generates.
And then tier two is
essentially the market purchases between paying for load. Now, typically, what PPA does is they tend to provide tier two from their excess hydro supply above critical water, but they basically factor it in at the market value, market cost to tier two customers. This currently is almost double tier one.
So you hear that. So right now, tier two prices are about double of tier one prices, okay? So it behooves us to have all of much of our load as possible in Tier 1. Now, what's the title of Ryan's No Worse Off Alternative? He does some calculations, and we end up with, I think it is about, what, 3 or 4 megawatts of headroom in Tier 1?
Well, currently we're about 1 megawatt into Tier 2, but under the new calculation, it would take us under Tier 1 and start a new contract with a little bit of headroom. I'm not sure of the exact amount.
So I think it benefits us to support Ryan, and what I was hoping to do is to get permission or blessing that that Clallam County is on board with the No Worse Off.
I don't like that title.
I don't like that. but I think it's the best alternative out there for Clallam at this point. John?
Yes, I think they're calling it option 3.
Option 3. You think that's better than No Worse Off? So I think that we should be supportive of the No Worse Off alternative, and that we should, in fact, I was asking about whether we would be sending anyone to the Bonneville meeting on December 8th.
I believe Tyler is going to be able to attend that meeting. And Rick's right, there's overwhelming support from when I was talking to Ryan last week that option 3 with WAPEG members appears to be how they want to go.
I caught some of that WAPEG meeting. I mean, wasn't able to do it all. One of those options, you would lose your credit for conservation, right?
Yeah.
Which one is that?
I think. Do you remember, John?
Well, I think option 1, they basically give you credit for conservation that is not obligated over and beyond. I believe under option 3, and I'm not absolutely sure, you do get a very narrow partial credit for your obligation.
Now, what John's differentiating there is that there have been a number of utilities that have gone above and beyond state and local or Bonneville requirements on conservation and really, you know, put a lot of money into it. And they're the ones that are wanting to have a bigger emphasis on getting credit for that. And when I'm talking about by getting credit, what that means is having room under Tier 1 for your loads to grow without going into Tier 2.
And they want to go in with headroom.
Right, yeah. The funny thing is, on the last contract, Tier 2 was cheaper than Tier 1. You know, after all these machinations of people trying to change the contract so that there was headroom under Tier 1, and then it ended up that Tier 2 was cheaper. Now, I do not, and I emphasize, do not expect anything like that to happen again.
No.
Because of the lack of thermal generation. So we've lost a lot of resources, and we're expecting a lot of load growth. So the expectation is that Tier 2 will probably, the difference between Tier 1 and Tier 2 will get larger than.
And CETA.
And CETA, yeah. Well, CETA is the thermal. Yeah.
It'll probably be at market, probably. Huh?
Yeah. So, I guess what.
And your assumption about load growth is coming from?
John?
Electric vehicles? Okay. That's where the load growth that you are seeing.
Basically, we believe that our load growth without electric vehicles will be mostly offset by future conservation obligations. But if we do have a vehicle electrification and consistent with state legislation, you know, we will see over the next 2 to 3 decades significant electrical growth.
You're forecasting 30%.
Well, for us, it's probably closer to 25 for us. If everybody or everything is electrifying via batteries, It will be closer to purpose.
So there's conservation requirements under the Energy Independence Act and CETA. How does that play with this? Is it, these are utilities that have gone beyond that?
Yes, yes.
Well, the reason I ask is I've seen, you know, output from the Power Council and even some of BPA's work shows that load growth is going to be flat, maybe increase a little bit. But
do you believe that?
That's what we pay them to do.
I'm asking, does that feel right to your gut?
Yeah.
Well, historically.
What's the loss going to be? I mean, if we're adding electric vehicles, you have to lose load somewhere. Tell me where that lost load is.
There's more power coming into the system.
Intermittent power coming in.
Lots of intermittent power.
Well,
it's still intermittent.
Look, I don't have a personal opinion here. I'm just telling you what the Power Council says and what the EPA says on some of their projections.
Well, I will trust that guy back there.
Well, I'll back up here. When the Northwest Power Conservation Council did their forecasting, there was prior to CETA and the mandate to transition to vehicle electrification. So they are doing approximately 40% of the electric vehicles, as our service did after the change in legislation.
I don't, Doug, disagree with your premise on the scenario that we ought to be behind in terms of, you know, Walpack's proposal. I think that's the safest.
Makes most sense, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I move that the Clallam County backs option three, rather than the no worse off scenario, and so that in public meetings we can be supportive of Ryan and his option.
Do we have a second for that?
Yeah.
Yes, we moved and seconded that we adopt the WAPAG option three going forward and be supportive of WAPAG to pursue that. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
One last point I'd like to make, and this is purely speculation. If global warming happens the way they think that it's going to happen, does that mean that we'll get a lot less snow in the mountains? I mean, I don't know. But as I was thinking about it in my head, there was an irony that presented itself. And that would be that, let's say that global warming does lead to less snow, but we still get the same precipitation. So it would be in rain. Okay. Wouldn't it be ironic someday if the reservoirs were used to provide the freshet in the spring that we used to get from the snow melt, if we don't no longer have snow melt? And, you know, it came earlier as rain and without the reservoirs to push it out as a freshet in the spring, it wouldn't be there. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen, but it occurred to me that that would certainly be ironic if it did.
I don't know that you get much more benefit out of this system than you can now, since other than Chief Joe and Grand Coulee, the federal system doesn't have that much storage dams. So that's not on the road.
No, it doesn't. It can store about, well, it depends upon the water here. It's a small amount, but it's still millions of acre feet of water that could be flushed to the system. When, if it, the snow's not there to melt, where would the water come from? There wouldn't be any water coming down at that point.
Yeah, but all we're doing is delaying time. We can't hold that much water. I can't argue the technical, but the amount of water, you know, I don't have those figures.
Then you have to factor in the Canadian reservoirs as well.
Yeah. And they and Micah, they've got some big ones up there.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I've got on the contract.
Okay, good. Let's move on to correspondence communications. Assistant General Manager John Firmus's request. John, do you have something on that?
I have a couple of things today. So first, on Assistant General Manager John Firmus's request, there were four that the board voted on, which was post his response on the POD website, a statement to all employees, a cover letter to the KOMP, and a cover letter to the Hays campaign. And just want to let you all know that those, all four of those things have been completed.
Good.
So that's been taken care of. I got an email from Energy Northwest earlier, Thursday last week, I think it was. They are planning to use their expertise at a JOA and take the lead for all of their member utilities in obtaining and applying for grant money. And they were asking for participants' willingness to participate in that. I told them that we were interested in partnering with them. They're bringing on maybe one or two FTEs to handle the influx of requests that are going to come down. And so any utility, member utility that's interested in a particular grant, we would let them know, and they would basically handle the writing and sort of the backlog of work that's going to take place with that.
And this is all levels of grants, from charging stations to infrastructure bill grants.
Everything.
SMRs.
Okay. And then the last thing, we received a request from the Jamestown Tribe to provide a letter of support. We wrote a letter of support to the Jamestown Scholar Tribe for a Department of Commerce Clean Energy Fund Electrification of Transportation Systems grant. And our role at the PUD would basically to be an advisor to their project to ensure close coordination with the tribe's electrical provider and ensure consideration of their electrical distribution system and modernization needs. So I wrote them a letter today that went out, and I can give you guys a copy if you'd like one.
No, it's been rumored that they're looking at green hydrogen and all kind of. Is that included here?
I'm not exactly sure what. It's just basically vehicle electrification. I'm not sure what the technology is. It says electric vehicles, so I'm assuming it's batteries.
Yeah. It takes a lot of energy for electrolysis of water, so I'm kind of wondering where they're going to get that energy.
Yeah.
That's not covered here. So it's
no, it's like just electric vehicles.
Okay.
And that's all I had for correspondence.
Okay, thank you. All right, commissioner reports. Jim?
Yeah, I attended the WAPAG meeting on the 27th and had to do the Western Resource Adequacy Program participation by BPA. Hear me? Maybe I should get closer to this. Pretty long presentation. Got into a lot of details about the participation and how it worked and so forth. And heavily loaded with a lot of technical work that needs to be done to make this program work. And I guess it's first off though, BPA said that they're showing that their projections for this winter in transportation capacity, they have plenty of capacity and they have a power surplus. So for their going in year in the program, they don't have an issue, And I guess several of us, including Ryan and I, have talked about this. It seems like a lot of process work for a little bit of benefit. And one of the comments that someone from BPA made is they believe that the cost of participation will be covered by the amount of money they might make off this. But it's not a it wasn't a very resounding kind of we're going to be great, we're going to reap it in. It was just sort of like, we should cover the cost of this. And I guess as he said that, I tried to wonder what is this. When you say you have a program like this, what does it really look like? Is there a new office full of people? How many people? Where do they sit? Do either one of you guys?
Are you talking about RAP?
Yeah. Is it 10 people someplace and, sitting with a bunch of computers? Or we don't know.
10 sounds too conservative to me.
John, I don't guess what that means, but I guess it's just, you got to wonder, okay, what are we paying for here and what is it really going to cost? And that, of course, they didn't really cover. They didn't say this is going to cost X amount of dollars per year. So anyway, the WAPAG is going to, is agreeing to, along with BPA to proceed with the implementation, try it out first year and see how it goes. But it looks like we're putting a lot of effort into solving appears to be a small problem.
I'm not sure I agree with that characterization. I think with resource adequacy, we're losing our base load resources. You know, the coal plants, and I'm not arguing that I like coal plants, but a base load resource that is on all the time and that you can count on gives you a much different resolution with respect to resource adequacy than replacing that with a lot of, and I'm not against intermittent resources, it's just that they're a different animal. So we're taking our resource stack and we're removing the baseload resources, we're replacing them with intermittent resources. I think if Bonneville were ever going to enter into a resource adequacy program, now is the time. And, you know, you ask about whether it's financially viable or not. You know, when people's power goes out, we've seen what that does to our folks. And we're talking about the whole region. We're talking about the West Coast. These folks are all working together to try to make sure that there's capacity and energy both when needed. Now, my concern that I had with it is that I don't want California leaning on our hydro system. And that, to me, is the biggest risk, is that we give up some of our resource adequacy to make California whole. Now, that I'm not – that's my biggest area of concern, but a focus on resource adequacy in the Northwest, I think, is long overdue, given the mandates that have come down, and I think it's quite appropriate.
I hear you, and I just, you know, again, point out that there's plenty of other information that feeds into this that say the future resources are being made up pretty quickly.
But they're being made up with intermittent, though, Jim.
Well, you know, enough intermittent with batteries and so forth to get, you know, you can build quite a stack.
Okay.
I mean, these people are figuring this out. They know what they're doing.
So you're questioning that they get paid? I mean, you were just saying, is there 10 people or how many people?
No, I'm talking about, do we know the operational cost of a program like that? Just, you know, what does it entail? We don't know.
Well, I mean, I think that that's part of what they're exploring this for, is they're trying to go get in and figure out, you know, what type of manpower does it take? How do we coordinate? You know, one of the harder things about this, in my opinion, you know, I used to manage balance for the month. So what does that mean? So, you know, once the month starts, then, you know, somebody has to be in charge of that. And when you're looking at meeting hourly, you know, loads, and you have a resource stack that is all over the place, you know, you need to have people focusing on that. And it takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of knowledge to be able to make that happen. So I think this is long overdue, and I think
all right, we'll see. We're headed there. So anyway, that's not important.
Well, good. There's a lot of interesting things going on. This is information came out of Clearing Up. The average cost of an EV, $66,000. The average cost of an internal combustion engine, and this is right now, of course, $48,000. The price of lithium used in EV batteries in July of 2022 is six times what it was 2 years ago. Six times. The reason I bring that up is that there are a lot of mandates being thrown at the electric utility industry. And it's going to be interesting when the rubber tries to meet the road, because when you have legislators mandating that everybody has to start using electric vehicles by a certain time, you can, you know, 66,000 versus 48,000, that's a significant amount of money. And the hope is, well, electric vehicles will go down in price. Well, lithium is six times what it was 2 years ago. Do you think the demand for lithium is going to go down? I don't think so. I mean, batteries are in high demand. Lithium, now, maybe there will be a new technology. And that's what my wife always talks about, that the technology cavalry comes riding over the hill at the right minute with new technology, and we can only hope that that's the case. I also noted that the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory has got a $1 million grant for recovering rare earths in red mud waste. That seems like something you get your kids to do, isn't it? Maybe we get some of the high school kids to work on that. So this is with respect to Oregon, but I thought this was interesting as well. Oregon consumed approximately 53.7 million megawatt hours of electricity in 2020. In 2012, that was 47 million. So it went from 47 million to almost 54 million megawatt hours in, 9 years. The top source for 2018 was hydropower at 39%. Coal was the second at 14.2 million megawatt hours, 26.5%. Natural gas was third at 11.5 million megawatt hours at 22%. Wind, nuclear, solar, wind was 7%, nuclear 3.5%, and solar 1.7%. Just trying to give you an idea of what CETA means. CETA takes away, this is like I said for Oregon, it takes away the coal and the natural gas, which comes up to 48% of the generation that Oregon used. That's sobering. I'm not arguing that I'm against it because I know it has to be done, but I'm just trying to give you the context of the size of the movement away from thermal generation to other types of generation. It's not insignificant. 48% of that resource stack is going away. Now, I don't know what loads are going to do, but let's say loads stay flat. Replacing 48% of a resource stack is going to be expensive. Either way you go, and you put load growth on top of that. I'm not against it. I certainly understand global warming. I'm just trying to give you the context of the size of the problem that the utility industry is facing. It's going to take a all-out effort, in my opinion, to get us there. That's all I've got. I'll get off my soapbox.
Well, I think you're right. The legislators don't seem to deal in realities. They don't look at things like that. Back to your cost of lithium, EV cost, you're just going to keep piling on gasoline taxes and push everybody to EVs.
Yeah.
And it's inflationary. It's all those things. It's just, anyway, boggles the mind. Anyway, and back to resource adequacy. Back during when Elliott was in place, he came to Energy Northwest and made a little speech that resource adequacy wasn't a concern for Bonneville. See, they've reversed that. You know, there's I belong to a resource adequacy task force, and there's competing, Southwest Power Pool and Cal ISO are competing for regional Western U.S. Balancing Authority. I'm getting the impression that the Southwest Power Pool is the preferred option there.
The SPP, SPP plus plus or something?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And again, it's California, Cal ISO is California-centric. They were formed for California, and they've pretty well lived up to that. So I think for the Northwest, Southwest Power Pool would be the better option.
And you know, the only counter I have to that, I was talking to Shauna McReynolds. I don't know if you know who she is. She's the – used to be – I know that. She just recently retired. She was the head at PNUCC for many years. I worked for her for a number of years, and I kicked this idea off by her. I said, well, you know, because I was like you. I was kind of leaning towards SPP. And she said, Rick, I have been working with some of these folks that came up from the Cal ISO. She said, I don't know if I've ever been in a room with smarter people. And I said, well, you know, it's one thing being smart. It's the arrogance that I have a trouble with.
Yeah, is that intelligence directed at representing the interests of California.
Well, she said that the technical people that she's been working with, She said that they were all in on making this not just a California-centric product, but something that would work for the West Coast. But I was surprised.
But you go back to CalISO governance.
Oh, indeed. The governance would have to change.
Energy imbalance market. I mean, yeah, it would have to because it is legislated that they will represent the interests of California.
Yeah. So, like I said, I was surprised, but I have a lot of respect for Shauna, and she her closing words was, give them a hard look. She said that there's a lot more there than what's being put in clearing up and et cetera, that there's not as much arrogance, and she just says that the people are top rate.
Right.
So just something to keep in mind.
It's where their allegiance lies, bothers me.
Like I said, the governance would have to change.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But see, we went into energy imbalance market with that same thing, that energy imbalance market board reports CalISO board, which is California-centric, and the solution was, I think they put two people from Northwest Public Power on the ISO, on the energy imbalance board, and that didn't do anything. So there's a lot of work to be done on that.
A lot of red lights,
yeah.
Or at least yellow.
Well, we had the Energy Northwest Executive Board meeting. Actually, it was combined Board of Directors and Executive Board meeting, and we had the Public Power Forum at Energy Northwest. I think, Sean, you were there, right?
Yes.
Interesting piece. Kind of the flavor of the speakers that are invited to those things has changed over the years. This guy was really hard over climate change. We've got to do something. The world's ending, blah, 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 which is fine. But it has changed somewhat, and you got to wonder, with all the money coming out with the DOE grants for new technology and nuclear reactors and all that, Energy Northwest sees an opportunity there. And they have. They've received, they're jointly entered into the advanced reactor program with DOE and $2 billion on the table. So it's worth going after. But anyway.
And real money.
It's real money. But having said that, we partnered with Grant to qualify. It had to be a nuclear operator and a utility.
Oh.
So we partnered with Grant over there, and that's kind of falling apart.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of funny. The staff, Kevin North was all in on this and all that, but when he got to their commission, and in fact, I saw this coming, was that it was a political decision. They wanted the reactor to be in their county, in their service territory. They wanted it to, the economic benefits to flow to their service territory and so on. Plus, they couldn't agree on technologies. They talked to NuScale, they talked to X-Energy, competing technologies. And anyway, it's just kind of fell apart at the commission. It's not dead yet, but it's not.
I'll tell you what, if someone were to drive up to me and want to put a nuclear plant in Clallam County, I think I'd be hard pressed not to require a lot of the benefits to accrue to Clallam County because of
it's understandable.
Yeah.
I mean, the commission is worried about re-election, and they're trying to benefit their local.
But also district, the risk.
The risk, yeah. But you got to factor in there what would be the public opinion of locating. So anyway, there's all kind of things there. But so besides that, the business part of the executive board was there's two opportunities right now. There's they're talking with Bonneville about a possible SMR on site one, which is licensed for nuclear activity right next to Columbia. And a lot of the old stuff from the Whoops and Site 1 reactor is still there. That's ongoing with Bonneville, talking to Bonneville, but Energy Northwest also would like the option of doing it on their own, getting subscriptions from utilities and so on. So we formed an LLC for that activity, or an SMR on Site 1. And the other opportunity is micro reactors. These are the less than 10 megawatt. They only have to be refueled every 8 years. They are come to the site in a container, set on the foundations, and away it goes for 8 years. And it's got walk-away safety features. And that's Department of Defense. The first one would be at an Air Force base in Alaska. So we formed a second LLC. We've got an agreement with Westinghouse to move forward micro reactors, whether it's Department of Defense in Alaska or wherever. Talking about resource adequacy, that may be an option moving forward.
When you were talking about mini and small reactors,
micro.
Yeah, is there a range, like up to 10 megawatts is micro, or?
Well, yeah, they're usually 10 megawatts and below.
It's micro.
For micro reactors.
And then small?
The SMRs are modular. So you can add modules.
Oh, I see.
And it is scalable, which is one of the advantages. You put in all of the facilities, for example, with NuScale, it's 12 modules they can accommodate. And this is in the water pool, below ground, all this stuff. But they are... And you can add modules as your load increases. So that's a real advantage there. So anyway, we formed those LLCs. We'll see how that goes going forward. But that's looking like a real opportunity for Energy Northwest. A lot of government money, the infrastructure money's out there, DOE money. And so we'll see how it goes. And what else on the power forum? They broke up into groups, you know, where you get little subgroups and you come back and report and all that. I miss most of that. Really don't. I don't particularly like that process. Okay, that's all I had there.
Well, I should also mention I was at that conference last week for 2 days too that John was at. He did a great job of presentations and a lot of good folks there. I think that meeting got a lot of leaders in the county kind of spun up thinking about future of energy in a pretty good way. So I think we could take advantage of that.
Good. Great. Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to staff reports. Peninsula Energy Futures Conference. John, are you going to talk on that one?
Turn on the lights. So, yeah, Jim touched upon it. The Energy Futures Conference last workshop was held in Blinn. It was sponsored by NODC and PNNL, and we actually had a small sponsorship for the workshop and a lot of participation. Jim's right, there was a lot of distinguished persons there, 70 individuals attended. It included two of the county commissioners, both Mark and Randy were there. Senior management from PNNL, group leaders, I believe about a dozen PNNL representatives, senior staff for the Jamestown Scalp tribe, as well as the Quinault tribe down south. They're not in our territory, but they're down south of us from the West End. We had Jefferson and Clallam PD commissioners, Dan, Jeff Randall, and Jim was there. Also, several general managers from PUDs, including Jefferson, Mason One, City of Port Angeles, their engineering person, as well as Jefferson PUD's engineering manager. A lot of emergency management groups in the North Peninsula were involved. Bonneville Power Administration came up, had two reps. McKinley, Fort Townsend Paper, their most senior management were there. We had the universities, the energy office, as well as the Clean Energy Institute representatives from Washington University. Transportation planners, regional transportation planners, Energy Northwest, Jefferson Climate Action Committee, and Department of Commerce and federal and state funders. So basically, I was tasked with giving an overview of the regional electric system, basically from source of generation in primarily eastern Washington to the points of delivery at residential homes throughout our county. And I believe it went fairly well. I got a lot of good questions, and it was a good start to the workshop. We also participated, myself and Colin Young, in our engineering department, participated in the reliability panel, reliability / resilience panel, along with Megan Uecker with the City of Sequim, Jimmy Scarborough from Jefferson PD, as well as Jack Neoborski from the City of Port Angeles. And what we did in that presentation was to convey basically the type of work we do on an ongoing basis to improve reliability within our service territories. Everything from underground cable replacements, underground conversions, tree trimming activities, projects specifically done really on every year that we do to improve reliability in our service territories. Then there was a panel discussion on emergency disaster response, and that was headed up by Diana Harvey, I believe, and Jim Buck, who our utility regularly deals with. And they focused on basically the problems you have in emergency, especially emergencies where you're without power for extended periods of time. Colin Young actually was on the planning committee that worked with that group from our utility. On emergency response, and they're thinking about basically a microgrid located at the William Fairchild Airport, which we volunteered our resources as well as the City of Port Angeles territory, but we volunteered resources or know-how to help them out getting that off the ground through grants. There's another panel discussion on emissions reduction. And that included myself, Thera Black, a transportation planner, as well as Megan Uecker again, Walt Weibach with Energy Northwest. And Thera Black was the planner, and Cindy Jane, which has been involved in greenhouse gas emission in Jefferson County for almost 20 years. I think she was did a lot of work on their first study back in 2005. And in that presentation, we gave an overview of where greenhouse gases came from and illustrated that 70%, roughly 70% of greenhouse emissions on the North Peninsula originated from transportation in some form or fashion. And that was the focus, how to reduce greenhouse gases through vehicle electrification, either batteries or fuel cells, and hydrogen fuel cells. And I gave an overview of potential impacts to the electric system. And the whole point of the discussion was that we had to address this problem not as an isolation of individual entities, but with an overall plan to do so effectively, to do so in a way that does not negatively impact the grid or cost a lot of money to put into the grid for it, because that can be done. We have time of use rates. We have preferred charging time, and the whole focus of that presentation was basically to illustrate that. Then there was a tribal energy goals panel, and that was led by Robert Knapp of Jamestown, as well as Gary Warashima of the Quinault tribe, and they gave a good overview of interest that the tribes locally had in energy projects. Is illustrated by the letter that Sean is supporting. And myself and Colin regularly work with Jamestown on their energy endeavors. Will, you mentioned hydrogen as a point of interest. That is a point of interest for Jamestown, but that is not what they're looking at going out of the gate because, locally we do not have the, knowledge base to see what that looks like. But part of this study may touch upon that. And that's what this letter is in support of. Also, there's an economic impact panel. It was led by Colleen McLear, who favorably highlighted EDC collaboration with our PUD, actually complimented us. and also the many challenges the area has with recruiting customers that have large energy requirements due to the constraints of new large single load North American Power Act, which she actually identified correctly and explained that situation. But there's a lot of restrictions that entails because large customers do not get the preference rate of power if you're above 10 average megawatts. There were also PNNL presentations and federal and state grant funder presentations and a lot of breakout groups. And I'll only talk about a couple of them. One of the reliability breakout groups, when we broke off into different groups, was basically reliability. And as part of that group, there were several involved, PNNL, myself, and BPA. And when we lined everything out, the single most important reliability aspect for the peninsula came down to our problematic BPA line between Port Anson and Sappho. And everyone agreed with that. That was basically the hardest problem to solve. There was a little bit of talk about cost-benefit analysis as it might apply to that. And I was pretty candid in pointing out that it's beyond that. I made a case that there's a minimum level of reliability service that should be expected irrespective of cost-benefit analysis. But if the lights are out all the time, it's unacceptable. And that builds into the definition of reliability according to NERC, North American Electric Reliability Council. It's subject, but at some point in time, you need to put numbers on what is the minimum accepted reliability. And I think I made a pretty good case of that. And also went over potential consequences if remediation wasn't done. Of course, that's been speculative, and I'm not going to go into that here. We also, our utility, myself and Colin, as well as Matthias, who also participated, we tried to, once again, give a holistic approach to energy projects. We gave an example as our microgrid project. But I made a point that if you're in emergency management and you want a microgrid based on a battery, perhaps you should partner with low-income citizens group or housing authority that has the potential to get a source through a low-income community solar and tie those together and get more out of the project without spending too much on any one project. And we expanded upon that, for example, if you did have a battery-operated microgrid, as, let's say, emergency management might, they could elect to go into a demand response program of our utility or Jefferson or the city where they actually might get credits for avoiding high demand charges on our BPA power bill.
So peak shaving you're talking about?
Well, no, basically it's related to peak shaving. Yeah, so basically what we would do, and we've been looking at this for, you know, since we talked about it a couple years ago, of actually utilizing our AMI system and some devices available, metering points, that can then be used to control everything from hot water heater or water heaters to also potentially distribution batteries or even electric vehicles. We talked about this 2 years ago. And where those microgrids, if it's safe for them to utilize the battery in a demand response mode, our plan would be to refund that customer how much it saves on our post-sale power bill. And it can be pretty significant. So when you put all those together, you can get a project that grant funders and reviewers of grants will see a lot of benefit to. So you don't do projects in isolation. You take basically a very broad approach in how you fund these projects because although there's a lot of money out there, there's a lot of entities that are going to be asking for funds. And that seems to be pretty well received. And that's our plan with our microgrid. If we have batteries in swim microgrid, we're going to build into the microgrid controller a way to basically use those batteries to reduce the demand charges we experience with BPA.
So John, how would that work? I mean, you would have to be actively managing or watching the load. to know when you're getting close to that peak number. So
okay, so basically we do have ways of measuring through SCADA and even system modeling. You tell me what the temperature is outside and the time of day, and I can tell you within 2% of what our load is, if I also know how much sun is shining. So basically, we can predict when we have a potential response that might coincide with a BPA demand charge, which occurs for 1 hour in a monthly billing interval. Now, we might have to do that two or three times in a month to make sure we're covered, because it's a little bit of guesswork. You might expect a high demand charge based on temperatures early in the month, but then later in the month, you might have an even lower temperature, might have to do it again. So we think, just like with our distribution scale battery that we talked about in the past, the 5 megawatt, how we're going to use that, we don't want to cycle the batteries too much because it reduces the life of the battery. But if we can limit it to once, twice, three, four times a month, the batteries will last 15 years.
So I guess I'm still trying to understand the logistics. If I'm understanding.
Let me back up. Okay, so basically we have an AMI system.
Okay.
So we have the potential real-time knowledge of what loads are.
So that means someone watching the loads?
It can be automated.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay, so basically we're approaching our conditions, temperature, load at certain substations, the time of day. That tells us whether we're likely to enter a demand response event. And if we're likely to, then we can send a signal to our AMI network that will tell the device that it's also a meter. It's not a conventional meter, but it's a meter that measures voltage and current. And we can tell that device that we need to engage a battery and or to turn off water heater. And by doing that, basically, you can get that into motion automatically. You don't have to have somebody controlling that. You can program it to do so. So that's kind of the basis. We talk about our demand response. We're planning to do that over the next few years, especially as we get into a new BPA contract. And this is just a benefit. Using batteries in this capacity is a benefit of the demand response that we're going to have to do.
Warner, did you have a question?
The major economics were you're going to have to
To some extent, okay, so basically the demand charges we incur, especially in the in the wintertime, are relatively hot. Right now, it's not quite economical to do so, but when you look at a battery that is there anyway, serving an emergency management function as part of a microgrid, then if the customer of that battery wants to generate additional revenue to pay for that battery, we can give them a funding stream based on the exact amount of money we're saving on a wholesale energy.
That's very logical. The is going to have to get away from this. 85% of the wholesale power bills, we're going to have to start redesigning that differently more economically.
Yeah, no, that's true. Right now, the current contract demand response is not typically cost effective. That's due to the BPA rate structure. But our understanding in the next contract is very likely to change.
Is that something I haven't been focusing yet? I don't think they've gotten to that level of detail in the contract yet, have they?
The only level of detail we have is the demand charge that we know when we're subject to it, how much it is. It's pretty significant. It's pretty significant portion of the bill. Now, the underlying fixed cost of BPA power widely varies from month to month.
Yeah.
Some cases.
Okay. So, John, there's been a demand response program. Energy Northwest has been peddling that for a long time. They had a couple of utilities that signed up. One of them dropped out. They're looking for utilities with large industrial loads, for the most part. But now they're getting down to water heaters and that sort of thing. So.
Well, we've been talking to Energy Northwest in the last year about that.
Okay, good.
We've expressed interest. We plan to use our existing AMI system and devices from our AMI vendor to make this happen. So that might not, you know, go well with Energy North, what they're planning. But you know, what we know it'll work for us. And Matthias is actually talking to Landis and Gear to basically get something up so that we can demonstrate at least one situation next year.
Well, didn't we participate in a hot water heater demand response and years ago?
Yeah, in 2004. Yeah, yeah. We participated in the BPA and TNL sponsored demand response program, and it actually worked pretty good, but it was very old technology, relays, and I think it was based on cellular type technology. It's not something, I mean, we want to do the same thing using our AMI network.
One other question. During this conference, did the extreme case of a Cascadia fault come event? Come up? I got a lot of questions about, well, if you go all electric and all that and you have a Cascadia event, power lines are down, you know, some batteries are not going to do you a lot of good. And even if they did, they don't be good. Everybody wakes up, plugs their EV in, deplete the batteries pretty quick, even if they were available. So.
Well, no, in the meeting, Diana is a very, she's a superb emergency management planner. And so is Jim Buck, but they know what's going to happen. Their primary concern is fuel as opposed to power. They do know that, you know, emergency generators, we have those, but will we have the ability to refuel those with all the bridges out and basically segmented into 21 different islands throughout the county? Now, with a microgrid, you could conceivably build that to some seismic standard, and I'm assuming they would. Otherwise, it's pointless, but they understand those problems. And things like nuclear, small modular, I mean, with Cascadia, it's very unlikely that would ever be permitted here, but who knows? Maybe one of the emergency plans.
Well, talking about generators, they're also trying. You're putting propane in the same basket as natural gas and trying to ban that. So how do you fuel a generator?
Well, they are banning.
You got a wood stove or what?
No, they are banning. The CSEA doesn't ban the use of emergency generation fuels. Now, ideally with CSEA, you want to migrate to a hydrogen combustion type generation or a hydrogen fuel cell so it's non-carbon. But as far as I know, CSEA doesn't play into anybody's ability to get standby generators.
Okay.
We can't get generators to generate power, but any of our customers can.
Coming to you, Warner.
All right. Hydrogen generation, that's the future.
There we go. Right. But by the way, Douglas is pretty far out on the curve for the hydrogen project. Mm-hmm. You probably know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, our next item is storm outages. Jason, give us the bad news.
Not bad. The good news now.
Yeah, it's all over now.
Yeah,
right.
Well, afternoon, commissioners. I'm Jason Seibels, operating superintendent. So pretty much kind of give you a rundown. I was the dispatcher on duty on Friday night hit about 9 o'clock-ish. Yeah, it was fun. But approximately, I mean, towards the Saturday morning, we had about 9,000 DE customers out approximately. And so at the get-go, we got in as many crews as we possibly could. We split them up into like 3-man groups to go do take care of safety issues, line down, tree down, poles down, that type of stuff, which our OMS system kind of the public has an option to push that on the OMS system when they call in, okay, you got line down or pole down, tree in the line, that type of stuff. So we spent all our crews not putting power back up, but to pretty much make sure our area was safe with any lines down. So we split them up all over the county. We had a few out in force, but nothing too terrible, which was really good. And we didn't lose the transmission, which was awesome also. So pretty much we're running around with, around our distribution system, services, that type of stuff. So when about Sunday night, I was still on duty down there, and we got down to about 39 Ole Miss tickets, which I was mentioning tickets. And right after that, when we got hit with the snow, so we jumped right back up to about over 3,000. And so from that point, so pretty much we had the first stint covered in 2 days. Our guys did an excellent job getting customers back on and everything. Answering service, our CSRs, engineering group, the line crews, facilities, helpers. I mean, the whole PUD was pretty much involved.
Yeah.
So then when the snow hit, we got hit again. So our guys were pretty much tired by then, but they tough through it and kept on going. And by Wednesday night, we had it down to approximately, I think, about the same, 30-something, 50 customers. And then pretty much by another 1, 2, 3 days, get customers back in. So, I mean, it was all hands on deck, and they did an excellent job. We didn't have to call in any outside mutual aid, which we were thinking of possibly doing, but our crews were able to handle it. What helped us out really quite a bit was our Forks crew was able to come in from Forks to help us out in here because they didn't get hit as bad. They had the hobo's head, which is normal. That always goes out, but they were able to get that back in. And then downtown Forks had a couple outages here and there. I mean, we had a big one, but it was able to get back in power pretty quickly. So then the whole crew was able to come in and help us out here, replace poles, broken poles. We had approximately 10 broken poles and quite a few lines down. So, I mean, the whole PUD got together and did an excellent job. So, I mean, if you have any other questions, you'd be more happy.
Well, back to the mutual aid. Mm-hmm. Surrounding utilities had the same problems we did, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Was there any mutual aid available? Probably not.
No, pretty much not. So just to give you a rundown, Snow Homer's PUD had about over 200,000 customers out. They were
wow.
Mutual aid about 8 to 10 crews. And they called up, which Bill Decker's our West Side coordinator. So they called him after the cruise, and we sent out a whole email to all the superintendents asking for help. They're like, "Oh, everybody's getting hit right now." So I didn't think they didn't get help until like 3 days later, maybe possibly 4 days later. Get mutual aid. Clark County sent a couple crews. Okanagan sent a crew. Grant sent a crew. So I mean, when that mutual aid does actually kick in, we need them. It helps out a lot.
Yeah.
And contractors were, you know, when you get hit really bad, then you start getting contractors in, which I think helped.
Well, there was a lot of positive comments on social media. I think on behalf of the commission, thanks to the PUD staff for how this was handled. Good job.
I appreciate that very much.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, one question. About how many transformers did we lose?
This one, once I look back, that I believe about approximately 8 to 10.
Not bad.
So, yeah, I mean, we had one pad mount that got smashed, which is that we're in dire need of, but that's a different subject. But overhead, yeah, we're still looking pretty good. We did hold off in September. We stopped putting out overhead transformers for new customers just because of the storm situation coming up. So we did that, and thankful that we did. So we are still looking decent for the rest of the winter.
So how is the transformer situation going? Are we getting deliveries, or John, maybe that's a question to you.
We've gotten a series of small deliveries, emergency ad hoc type deliveries, just to handle emergency situations. We're still waiting on large shipments that will basically put us in a good position as far as fulfilling all existing requests. We are a little bit more optimistic. We had a lot of transformers from Howard Industries that were backlogged. Starting in September, we had a lot of scheduled deliveries from Cecil Maloney, another major manufacturer, and they're saying we should be getting some relatively soon. Howard Industries basically announced a cost escalation for transformers ordered after January of 2022, which is actually the first time we've seen that they're actually making transformers.
Yeah.
So So we remain optimistic. The requests for new services, you know, have come down considerably, you know, maybe economics, otherwise, economic outlook, but yeah, we're still hoping for transformer and getting a very few ad hoc shipments that help us out and try to stay ahead.
So we're still buying transformers that are a little bit south of our normal specification? Is that...
to say the least. So basically, any special specifications we apply to transformers, that went out. So, we're actually looking at, I almost hate to say this, but we have a supplier in China that is willing to sell us 60 pad mounted transformers that we're looking at. Seriously looking at.
Yeah, we're going to go ahead.
That's excellent.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing that we strive this year is no one got her.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, and I want to personally commend Jason. He was the dispatcher out of the gate, and probably his first big storm, and he handled it. I mean, I could not ask for anyone to do as well as he did. First time out of the game. How many hours did you work initially? Don't say that. Sorry.
Jason, this meeting's being recorded, so you got evidence.
This is the first outage that I have almost, since I got kicked upstairs, this is the first outage that I really had no involvement in, and they did it well better than I.
Good job.
Yeah. Good. Fantastic.
Any other questions?
Be sure to let the crews know how much we appreciate the time and effort and sacrifice that they made. And I'm sure we'll show up for Chile on Thursday, but make sure that they know that their effort is really appreciated.
Yeah, I did that all through the storm. Every time they called in for something, I said thank you, and customers thank you. Yeah, so.
Our most important commodity is our employees.
Yeah, correct. I hear that.
Thank you, Jason.
Yeah, thank
appreciate
you.
It. Okay, board action items.
You know, I did not capture any board action items. Goodness. Unless something got by me, but I don't think so.
We're a bunch of slackers.
The corrections to the budget.
The corrections to the budget. We did approve the budget. The budget was approved, but we will be making those corrections.
Okay. All right. Our next item is comments from the public. Do we have comments from the public? Please raise your hands if you're virtual. You do or you don't?
I do not.
Deplorable lack of curiosity. Okay. All right. We're now going to recess our normal meeting and go into an executive session to evaluate the qualifications of an applicant for public employment or to review the performance of a public employee pursuant to RCW 42-30-110. Section L and G. So,
we're out of the executive session, and there's no business come before the commission and senator.
I'm